Blessings. I'm your host, Keir Knoll, and I welcome you to The Red Path. At the age of 19, after a near-death experience, Stephen Martin chose the life of a wilderness ascetic, during which he acquired a direct indigenous knowledge, a gift born of solitude. After 4 years, he writes, feeling almost all loss of human form, he knew it was time to return, and the really hard work began, integrating back into Western society and not losing the connection, wisdom, and gifts he'd received in the forest. 20 years hence, Stephen refers to the co-creation of the Madawaska Forest Garden as the cumulative event of his life. Here was an experiment that explored what he learned about the indigenous ways of gardening, and here he is expressing an astonishment and an unabashed enthusiasm for the result of this love affair with the earth.
And holy smokes, man. So this site now is 22 years old. There are trees that are 50 feet tall. And if you tried growing a tree out in these exhausted fields, like where my farm is, well, it'd be about 10 feet tall in the same amount of time. And that's with full sun. You know, so it's just incredible how we missed the boat, you know, and I really hope the word of the Madawaska Forest Garden kind of gets out, because it basically blows permaculture and all these things out of the water, because suddenly you realize that you don't actually have to manipulate the land so much to work with it. You just have to pay attention to the natural synergies and the natural ways that it reproduces and revitalizes itself.
Stephen describes his near-death experience as akin to when we find our first love, and he describes his 4 years alone in the wilderness as his spiritual honeymoon. He often refers humorously to his mode of gardening as tantric gardening. In his own words, from his book Sacred Gardening, Stephen writes, "The eros of the earth is our eros. This is the energy of love, sexuality, fertility, and co-creation. I'm wanting to convince you to use something you already know and possess deep in your heart, and to give that love back to the earth. Working with the eros of the earth, or with a human partner, is like wading into the ocean and feeling within your body what the water wants you to do. You can go with the waves or against them." In fact, in my discussion with Stephen, the way he used language to describe his profound experience made me feel at first like a tourist struggling to master a foreign tongue. But as we talked more and more about the self-defeating underpinnings of Western rationality and the full reality of an erotic relationship with Earth Eros that had been covered over and lost, I began to see Earth the way he saw it and experiences it as a lover, and his work, in the noblest sense of the word, as a co-creation. My talk with Stephen is divided into two parts. This first part deals with the spiritual nature of Stephen's experience, which requires so much deconstruction of what we thought we knew. Part two will continue our discussion and treats hands-on aspects of co-creating a garden on Earth.
Stephen, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I think I'd like to start. Let's start with an origin story. When did you feel a sense of connection, or how young do you remember feeling a sense of connection with the wild? And who were the people that facilitated and led you on this path?
You know, I think most often that connection, it was for myself, and just watching my kids and other kids and stuff, I'm kind of see that fairly universally that connection is revealed through your relationship with animals. Because, of course, in the culture that I grew up, because I grew up in the suburbs of Toronto, so pretty detached in lots of ways from reality and like living off the land. But, of course, our animals, you know, are these key intermediaries between ourselves and nature. And some kids just don't really resonate with animals or have that much of an interest. But for me, I had more interest in my animals than I did in the people that were around me. And I probably spent more time with them too. I had a golden retriever, growing up. His name was Magoo. And basically, we used to just go hide. We'd go into the bushes, or back in the ravine behind the house, and we'd just hang out. And I was always so happy and so content to be with the animals. So even though my world and a lot of my teachings are about plants, I'd really have to say it was the animals first that was the thing that I really connected with. And that, was kind of, and I believe there's studies on this, that there's something about animals that open you up to that other world, because essentially most of us are going through life in, and I don't mean this in any, derogatory way, but in a kind of a autistic state. We're locked in ourselves and we can't bridge out into nature, into the natural environment, because nobody showed us how to. But animals act as these intermediaries that help us come that way,
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's what comes to mind.
Actually, when we moved out to our land in Shepherdstown, we brought along a cat and a dog, or we actually added a dog later on. I was always sort of envious of them, because I saw them adapt and become one with the land in a way I felt that I was alienated and I could not find that same access.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I think that's probably true. And just like ourselves, if animals have been confined enough, they actually won't adapt ever. Like, I've seen apartment cats that just couldn't make the jump, mm-hmm. Anything that's isolated long enough, it's like it actually creates kind of a permanent boundary around the thing, and it has a hard time jumping over.
Mm-hmm. So you sort of found your community. I think this was your community very early on, and it involved not necessarily humans as your primary point of contact, but animals and nature.
Yeah, that's so true. And I really, it's funny, I live in this area that it's kind of like a back to the land mecca. It started in the 60s because of draft dodgers coming up from the U.S. and trying to avoid the Vietnam War. And the land was very cheap, and it's a very backward kind of area in the sense of, again, not to offend anyone, but back in the day it was called the Ozarks of Ontario, which is to say very undeveloped in certain ways, which is a good thing, right?
Absolutely.
Because it gives you an opportunity to connect with an age and a time in a reality that's been kind of wiped out in more developed areas. Mm-hmm. So, when I first started coming up here, I realized that there was this huge community, back to the lander community. But of course, I came here when I was like 35 or something. So I'd already been through all my initiations and trials with the earth and seeked out elders and all these people. So it's kind of icing on the cake to come to a place like this, but I'm almost envious of younger people who have a chance of actually finding a human community where you could expand out in this direction, mm-hmm. One of the first people I actually came across written or otherwise was this fellow Sunbear. You ever heard of him?
I have not.
Okay, he kind of faded out. I'm not sure if he's still around or not, but he was quite a big thing back in the early 80s. Hmm. And he had this slim little volume, and it said Living in the Wilderness. Oh. And it was full of basic skills like fire making, trapping, how to tan things, how to prepare meat, how to store food for the winter. Real kind of old school survival stuff. And, it took me years and years of experimentation and working with those little fragments of knowledge which he's an indigenous person, and so that's where those fragments came from, before I could kind of move into that reality. And, you know, there's something to be said for experimenting, because you do claim the knowledge for yourself in a deeper way than when you can just walk into a workshop and somebody demonstrates everything and you just copy them or whatever. You have to live these things for a number of years. But at the same time, there's a certain part of me that thinks, wow, you know, I could have been bumping along on this road a lot earlier if I'd had the right mentors at the right time. So then again, you know, I had my grandfather, and I did have other individuals who helped me immensely, and lots of people don't even have that, you know, so.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about your relationship with your grandfather, with your immediate family. I know you had a special connection with him.
Yeah, well, my grandfather, he was a veteran, and he was a farmer. He was a big fan of Wordsworth and other romantic poets of that same era. And so I think he, you know, I believe I say this in the book too, he had more of an influence on me than I could ever imagine, I'm sure, or understand. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, those influences you have when somebody shows you a plant, or they show you a hole in the ground, and then they show you a little trail and a couple little hairs that indicate who that hole belongs to. Suddenly a whole world can open up for a young child, right? And you might not ever remember that person. You might have just met them once or something, but they can do this incredible thing where, again, they can kind of bridge the realities for you. And I'm sure he did that in more ways than I can ever remember. But one of the most graphic ways is he was a master gardener, and he was a grafter. So he knew how to graft fruit trees and all that kind of thing. And so in a typical way, our suburban lot, which was big because it's back in the day, had crabapple trees, which, you know, they plant for the flower, for the beauty of the flower primarily is why they used to always plant them. Mm-hmm. And of course, my grandfather, you know, I'm sure he would have just been like, you know, so he got apple grafts, and on all these trees he put apple branches. Oh. So here were these crabapple trees, and then at a different time a different flower would happen, and those flowers would produce apples on those trees, big beautiful apples. And this was mind-blowing to me. Like, I just couldn't grasp, even though I'd seen him do it and stuff, I just couldn't grasp how that was even possible. So this man could work miracles as far as I was concerned, you know. And I'm sure on all sorts of levels, I wanted to emulate him.
I like to think about mentoring experiences, and it seems to me that something like mentoring, you're not being given information, information's not being deposited in your brain. Somehow something awakens in you when you are mentored, and you have a sense of wonder and magic.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, like a lot of things, we've kind of secularized or stripped this thing. So even the word mentor, it's not a good word, I don't think, for me anyways. It doesn't really capture the intimacy and the importance of the two-way exchange. It's not mm-hmm. just that they're giving something to you, you're giving something to them. Mm. And as a teacher, I'm keenly aware of this, that everybody who I teach, like who comes to the school here, they're bringing something to me, you know, and the fulfillment that I experience by giving something to them in this exchange is so powerful. And then in retrospect, you can say, oh, I got so much from that person and they were a mentor, but I like the word grandfather or grandmother, right? Oh, which was a way that indigenous people indicated a teacher mm-hmm. or an elder. You know, because a grandfather or a grandmother more captures that caring. They care about you personally, in a deep, deep way. And this is essential for that exchange of spirit to happen.
I love that. So
it's mentoring, not just about knowledge.
I think I'd like to call the process you're talking about grandfathering or grandmothering. Turn it into a verb.
Yeah, sure. I like that a lot. Yeah, I like that a lot more.
Now, one thing that struck me, also, I'm going to read just one passage from Sacred Gardening. You said, Western culture's mythic consciousness was being eclipsed by the monotheism of Christianity. Some of the old stories and teachings were lost to the flames and torture of Inquisition. Others live hidden in Christian scriptures, and others still live on, propped up into fairy tales or ghost stories. They also live hidden in our bones and in the bones of the land. And the reason that struck me is because I feel like we're, you know, we're metaphorically, even in this moment, we're walking away from the lines that are straight and the perfectly level cityscape, say, and we're metaphorically walking into the wilds, and maybe it's a little scary. Maybe there's a sense of wonder that we bring with us when we do that.
Well, for sure. I was really kind of blessed to find out this thing years and years ago that Indigenous people had no word for wilderness. Right? You kind of got to give your head a little shake there, but of course, it was their home. So we recognize that wilderness as something that's very alien from ourselves, that's outside our little quadrant of understanding. Whereas Native people, because they were so completely integrated with this reality, they had no word for that. Right? It's like certain cultures, like Balinese culture, for example, had no word for artist. For the same reason, because everybody was an artist. It was assumed if you were a human being, you were an artist. So it's all right there in our language, our alienation, you know, from these things that are really just human things. And now they're seen as some sort of hard to achieve mystical reality or state or something. But it's only because we've moved so far away from it and fenced ourselves off from it in so many ways. I mean, one of the things that I start with teaching when I used to teach in the college was, I'd say, look at our bodies. Look at your feet. They got these big nylon and plastic and rubber things surrounding them. Our bodies are all wrapped up in these things, clothes. And then we're sitting on a chair, and then we're in a room that's in a bigger building. So it's just degrees of isolation and isolation and isolation from reality. So then what I get people to do is try to separate from the earth. And those listening at home can try this if they like right now. So, you know, when you jump, what you immediately find is that you're connected to the earth. You can't separate yourself from the earth, and you say, okay, well, that's gravity. But if gravity, of course, is a huge diminishment of this fact. It's like a typical way that we kind of push the most obvious, mystical, powerful thing away, which is that we're part of the earth and we can't separate from her. But we've created these illusions for, well, at least a couple thousand years, you could say, that are creating separations and separations and separations, because that house is in a town, and the town is separate from the wild as well, right? And so on and so on and so on. And then you wonder why you can't connect with nature. Well, you know, give yourself a break, right?
Mm-hmm. And if we go back through history, I mean, you discuss this somewhat in your books. You know, there was a whole scale eradication of our connection, our primal connection with the earth, with nature, through the Middle Ages, through the Inquisition, and we can reach all the way back to Plato and talk about how there was this fundamental cleaving from our soul from essential reality.
Yeah. I mean, I even think about that word soul. The soul is the bottom of your foot. It's where we connect with the earth.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yes.
So even these things, you know, again, there's still remnants of it in our language, but you know, we're nothing without that connection, right? Mm-hmm. That's where we come into ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it goes back, of course, further than Plato. I mean, we cite that as kind of the origins of Western culture. And, you know, as we were talking about the other day, Mr. Kingsley there, Peter Kingsley, has done some incredible revelatory thing about that time period.
The dark places of wisdom.
So the political agenda of Athens at the time to become the center of power. And, you know, this has happened over and over again and is still happening, is that the truth is being altered for political reasons. You know, and so this is the first place to look for deception, right? For subterfuge, for all the things that are used, the collusion, you know. It's incredible. Like, I live in the what's called the Upper Ottawa Valley right now. And unfortunately, there's a nuclear facility about an hour away from me, north of here. And what they're planning is for that to become a nationwide storage site for the waste materials from nuclear facilities all over Canada and maybe even the States. I'm not sure. But I was just watching it's kind of like a public hearing about it yesterday. I'm going to go to it tomorrow. But it just makes you insane with the doublespeak. Like, all these people in one department and another department are all like, oh yeah, we got this covered. You know, this person's watching this person and there's nothing to worry about. It's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, this is the most toxic material on the planet. It will be toxic for half a billion years. And these guys say they've got it covered? Holy shit. Like, we can get so far up our own asses that we can't see anything. And this is like a perfect example of it, is this whole nuclear thing is just incredibly backwards. It's beyond backwards. It's terrifying. Right? And nobody says the word toxic. It's right beside the Ottawa River. That's one of the main tributaries in Canada. It was one of the main tributaries in North America. It's comparable to the Amazon or the Mississippi. And if this thing, if there's an earthquake or something happens, it will pollute everything downstream, including the nation's capital, Ottawa, and then into the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes and the ocean. And what a fucking bunch of bullshit. Sorry for my language. I just get so infuriated when I even just start thinking about it. Because these people in their suits and their ties and their 9-to-5 jobs, and their good jobs too, they're very well paying, because of course somebody's getting screwed, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever somebody's getting paid really well, guaranteed somebody else is getting screwed. So this is the thing, and these people all have themselves so fooled that they actually think that what they're doing is a good thing. And guess what the driver is? Money and politics, of course, right?
Yes, yes.
So holy smokes, it's still going on. That was all, that ramble was all just to say it's still going on in a huge, huge way. And, you know, I don't have to tell you guys down there, you got a real estate developer for a president, so I'm sure you know all about it.
I didn't consider it a ramble at all, and I think the language is entirely appropriate, because we do need to be passionate and very upset about what's happening to the earth. Would love to hear what your thoughts are on the recent protests at Standing Rock and the sacred purpose that was found there.
Oh, man, you know, well, it's a beautiful thing, right? And I hope those people keep it up, and I send my blessings to anybody who's supported them or involved in that, because It's just the same battle over and over and over again. And, you know, whether it's about uranium or a pipeline shipping crude oil or, you know, any number of other things, it's the same battle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's all we can do, right, is stand up and be counted, you know.
Yeah,
and
one of the
ultimately
one of the things
I have so many again ways of kind of putting things off, and they wait till things die out, you know, till the popularity of something dies out, and then they slip it through some other way. So it's really about your own backyard, you know. And again, that's why this nuclear thing that's happening in my backyard is so humiliating to me. And I feel so much shame about letting it happen. And if I thought laying my life down would stop it, I'd do it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm serious about that too. You know, but there's no point in getting killed or put away in jail forever for no reason.
Right.
So whatever I write and I talk and, you know, that's about all I can do. And I suppose that's true for all those folks at Standing Rock, you know, and to create more media awareness about it is kind of almost the only thing you can do, right? And lay yourself down. Like when those bulldozers come, man, those elders and those people who step out in front of that, especially the elders, man, you got to really, really give it to them and bow down for somebody who's lived that long of a life and been suppressed so much and screwed around so much, but they still have their center. They still know what's important. And again, I can't give those people enough credit for really, you know, sticking it out with that.
Yeah, I don't think we, to my way of thinking, watching Standing Rock, experiencing it, not firsthand, but watching and reading about it, I was simply astonished at the sacred purpose and the peaceful protest that was involved in that, and I don't think we've had anything like that kind of sacred purpose since Martin Luther King. And it seems to me that Standing Rock, kind of, the American Indian movement back in 1973, there was violence, and it didn't end well. One of the things that the aftermath of that is Leonard Peltier is still in prison for something that they can't prove that he did. But Standing Rock did something peaceful. The only violence that was at Standing Rock from their side was actually done by infiltrators who provocateurs, agent provocateurs, I think they call it. They came in and actually caused the violence, and it was clearly documented. But I was just amazed at how strong that sacred purpose was, how strong the grandmothers were, how strong the kids were, how brave and strong they were. And it has to come from some higher connection, some duty to the earth.
Yeah, or some lower connection.
Mm-hmm.
You always got to watch that higher and lower stuff, eh?
Yes.
It's just always dangerous, our models, you know, and the words we use for things.
Yes,
but
yes.
Truly, truly a beautiful thing, you know, and whether it succeeds or not, it doesn't take anything away from that. And that in itself becomes a seed for other people, right? Because if you can see that, you know, apparently, like, I don't know, at least, you know, I've heard, I guess, a couple different stories of how it all started, but at least one of them had to do with very young women and social media and getting the ball rolling and kind of calling people out to this thing. And wow, you know, that's amazing. But again, with the young, for me, somehow it's less amazing because the young have their eyes open, and sure, you know, society does everything it can to shut their eyes and distract them and all that stuff. But basically, young people are very together in a certain way, right? They know everything. When you're young, you know everything. you haven't done anything, but you know everything, right? And that's what drives us all crazy about teenagers, is they can see right through most adults, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, they haven't actually proven themselves. They haven't been initiated themselves, so...
They have nothing invested in the system. I think as we grow old, we make compromises and we sort of become invested in the system. They don't have that investment, so they can see it. It's like the emperor has no clothes. It took a child in that story.
Yeah, and so for sure, that's exactly what I'm saying. Is you know, it's beautiful and it's powerful, but somehow when an older person, an elder, who has invested and had all those years and that time, can still stand up, it's, for me, it's even more amazing, you know, and more beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit more about science, and then I really want to move on to some of your practical techniques. And I wanted to be sure it was put in the proper context, that these are sort of guideposts and not a laundry list of things you have to do. But before we get into that, getting it in this proper context, I wanted to say a little bit about science and see what your thoughts were on it. When I was a child, there was a scientist, behaviorist named B.F. Skinner. And I remember as a very, young teenager, his comment, he did behavioral studies on rats and mazes. And he said, a human being is nothing more than a rat in a maze. Emotions are an illusion. And I half believed this. I knew it couldn't possibly be true. I kind of rejected it, but I kind of half believed it. And then I actually was practicing as a scientist for a few years in graduate school. You know, I'm a sort of a student of the philosophy of science, and all of a sudden, scientists said that there were emotions, and you know why? It's because I got a bright, shiny new toy, the positive emission tomography techniques that allow them to see the emotion. So once they had their toys, once they had the tools to see it, all of a sudden they declared to us confidently that emotions were real. And that's just one example. There's so many examples of how science will loudly and confidently declare something to be true. And it's not the scientists themselves. It's more of what our culture, our dominant culture, takes away from it. And then we find out that, yes, in fact, what we believed was amazing about us, or what we believed was amazing about the Earth, actually, the Earth is just that extraordinary. And I wonder if you could comment a little bit on how science and people that believe, basically follow a religion of science, are really cutting themselves off from the complexity and the majesty and the magic of reality.
You know, it's the context of it, right? I mean, what puts it in a different light is to talk about indigenous science. Mm-hmm. The people have always connected with things and tried to experiment a little bit and tried to kind of figure out what's going on. But, you know, the whole methodology is different. The set of signifiers is different. And the connotations of it all is different. So the way that it comes out is all very different. So that spirit of inquiry is such a good thing. But again, it's the Western cultural context is always towards industry and harnessing Mother Nature, you know, the whole back to Descartes and all that nonsense, you know, which is like the Earth's just a machine, everything's just a machine, and, you know, we can play around with these things to get the most out of them, kind of thing. And, you know, it's horrific. So, you know, I bash science quite a bit, but quite rightly, it's not science, right? It's the direction that the inquiry has been pushed. And in a very, very practical sense, of course, who's got the money to do this? Well, for example, the nuclear industry, the military industry, the medical industry. So these things have nothing to do with peace or healing or safety. That's all just a bunch of bullshit. It's all just a way for people to make money. The whole medical industry is a spoof. It's like a joke. I've had half those diseases myself and cured other people of the other half. So I can tell you there's no need for hospitals. There's no need for any of that stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? We never had that stuff before. We don't need it now. Sure, we learned some things about child mortality and how to not have so many children die. And maybe that was valuable. Maybe it isn't. You know, that's entirely debatable. But other than that, it hasn't changed life expectancy at all. That was the only thing that brought the life expectancy down, you know. Like, we always hear this thing that, oh, people used to live to 35 or something. That's complete bullshit. That's during the early industrial age in Europe. Most of the time, people lived to a good, ripe, old age if they got past their youth, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's as it should be. So, again, these things are industries, and to see them as anything other than that is to delude yourself. And then you put your life on the line. Like, people have such deep faith in these things that, you know, they're getting screwed over all the time. And, like, here in Canada, you know, everyone's like, oh, we've got medical coverage, and isn't that great? Well, no, it's not great, actually, because all of the money goes to pharmaceutical industry. You know, so it's actually a joke. You know, you guys don't have as much coverage, and it's probably a good thing. Hmm. And sure enough, what you find is way more herbalism in the States, way more alternative care, because you're going to have to pay for it one way or another. So you might actually think about it for a sec. Whereas in the North here, we don't have to pay to go to the hospital. So nobody ever thinks about it. It's just like church or something. You just 100% believe and you go when you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but like, whatever. I mean, just for myself, I think I've seen a doctor maybe twice in the last 40 years, like in my whole adult life. And mostly it was just to talk to them and see what their opinion was, right? I didn't expect them to actually do anything for me or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But, there I go ranting again. I can't remember what the question was.
you answered the question quite well. Just wondering about the sort of the omnipresence, the oppression of science and their confident declarations.
Oh, yeah, science, right?
Science itself, Karl Popper said that science is that which is falsifiable. So basically, scientists or the proponents of science in the media, not the scientists themselves, but we seem to always get the worst of the philosophy coming out in the media. That if science is that which is falsifiable, basically scientists are coming to us and saying, "Believe us until we're proven false." And that's pretty much the march of science, is they say things and it has philosophical implications, then all of a sudden it's just found out to be wrong. And it's you know, there's far more magic out there than we ever imagined.
It's so true, eh? And it's happened so often, like, as you say, over and over and over, but we never seem to get it. This whole battle that's going on around herbs now and them needing to be classified and having DIN, drug identification numbers. So this has happened in a big way in Canada now. You can't sell herbs as a medical thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can sell them as bitters. You can sell them as a flavor. But you can't sell them for what we've been using it for 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because if it doesn't have the drug identification number, which means they have to find the active ingredient, right? So this is such a load of crap. With certain herbs, like, say, yarrow or something, yarrow has over 200 active chemicals in it. 200. Mm-hmm. And then there's the interaction between them. So to isolate one chemical and say that this is going to be the marker for the quality of this herb, and everybody has to get their herb tested. And, you know, again, no offense, but typically this is coming from Germany, is where all this started, right? It's this Germanic way of thinking where everything can be broken down and categorized and stuck in a box. And say with St. John's wort, in my lifetime, well, not in my lifetime, just in the last 20 years, they've changed that marker twice. So at one point they were saying it was this chemical, and then they found another chemical, And then they found another chemical. And so, you know, there, it's absolute when it's found, right? That whole thing of, I can't remember your phrase there, but just acknowledging right from the start that it might be wrong is disappeared. Mm-hmm. As soon as the chemical's found, the thing is like, okay, this is the thing. And so then they want to take that thing out of St. John's wort and genetically splice it. I'm not making this stuff up either, into potatoes so that people can have antidepressant potato chips.
Oh my God. Oh my God. So, I mean, you know,
this isn't revealing the consumer, you know, it's just insanity.
You were talking about the Germanic way of thinking. Well, you know, the one of the first mass produced medications came from Germany, the aspirin, which, you know, they found out that it came from the willow bark, and they found a way to synthesize a chemical that was very similar to the willow bark. The willow bark doesn't have the problem of possibly causing stomach bleeding. Aspirin does. So right from the get-go.
In fact,
yeah, go on.
Yeah, absolutely. Good example. It's a digestive. It actually helps with your digestion and the stomach, the whole, you know, digestive tract. So, you know, again, it's a perfect example, and it's the first one, and it's the most simple one. And then you think about all the crazy stuff they're making now that doesn't have any organic origin, no natural origin. You know, it's arguable that, you know, at some point back there's an organic origin for everything, but things that are made strictly from, guess what, petroleum products or petroleum product byproducts, you know, and that's what's in our food and that's what our medicine's made of. Yeah, it's really alarming. Like, the more you start to learn about these things, everything, you can talk about milk, you can talk about meat, you can talk about juice, you can just look around your kitchen. And, you know, it gets so, well, you pretty much have to live like I'm living, which is that you make everything or you know the person who did. And this is the only way to get out of this whole industrial mess mm-hmm. that basically people are trapped in.
Absolutely.
You know, when you think you're buying organic, you know, and that this is somehow going to get you out of that mess. But of course, organic is just industrial with organic inputs. What organic used to mean is that you had an ecological system on the farm that was basically a beautiful, beautiful integrated system that, you know, we developed over a couple thousand years of how to farm properly. All that, you know, got thrown aside during the Green Revolution, which I just found out recently, by the way, the whole Green Revolution and agriculture was called that not because it had anything to do with green. It was in stark contrast to the Red Revolution of the communists. That's why we called it the Green Revolution.
Oh my
God. Just found that one out.
Wow.
So classic. But,
wow.
Because it had nothing to do with anything green is right. It had everything to do with chemicals and manipulating farmers into buying these hybrid seeds. And so over and over and over again, you can see how, you know, the economics of the situation have altered the truth of what we know about stuff.
If you like this podcast, please look for part two with Stephen Martin on theredpath.org. Part two continues our discussion and deals with hands-on aspects of co-creating a garden on Earth. Stephen will be speaking at our very own Sacred Roots Herbal Sanctuary in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, on February 20th. If you'd like to hear, see, and meet this remarkable visionary, please check out the website sacredrootswv.com for event details. His stop here is in the middle of a mid-Atlantic tour that includes stops in New York, Prattsville, New York, February 17th, and Brooklyn on February 18th. And following his stop in Shepherdstown, a 3-day workshop in Crozet, Virginia, February 23rd through 25th. Just in case you were wondering where Crozet, Virginia was, I checked it out. It's 15 miles west of Charlottesville. If you liked what you heard today, and or if you come to Sacred Roots Herbal Sanctuary on the 20th and really like what you learned but it leaves you wanting a deeper knowledge, you might consider a trip down to Crozet, where you will experience Stephen's teachings firsthand in a 3-day workshop. For event details and for many, many other things besides, including his two published books, check out Stephen and Megan's website at thesacredgardener.ca. In the last chapter of his book, Sacred Gardening, Stephen writes, "There are hundreds of options contained within each cresting moment. In our conversation with the earth, we discover what possibilities there are and be enabled to move forward into them. To me, these visions are not imaginings, but realities that already exist, which I am remembering into this time." I'll end with one last quote from Sacred Gardening, a prayer for change. "I call in all my relations, flyers, walking ones, crawlers, swimmers, and all our ancestors. I thank you deeply for your being, for your presence. I thank you, and am so grateful you are here with us now. I am asking you for help to see and manifest Earth's dream of life, to overcome ignorance and fear, and to acknowledge the wrongs we have done. Help me to understand with an open heart why we have acted so selfishly, and help me see the root of these dark truths and pull them from the garden. Let their bodies feed the flowers of life. Aho, and thank you all for listening. This is Kier Knoll on the Red Path."